Hey everybody, Stevie Van Zandt here, and you are watching The Hole Podcast.
Welcome to The Hole. I am Rob Spranz.
And I'm Lori Levine.
We are joined by Stevie Van Zandt. This is an interview, Stevie, that I've wanted to do for a long time. We always used to record our show at the Comedy Cellar on the same block as the Cafe Wa, and I would always come out and see you outside, and I'd be like, I want to ask him to come up, but I never did. So I'm finally happy to have you on, and it's for great reason, because Stevie has a book out called Unrequited Infatuations, which, to give you an idea of how much I loved it, of course, when we do interviews, they send us, you know, something to read, or they send us a copy. After about one to five pages, I immediately bought the audiobook because I wanted to hear you tell it. Like, it's really that good. Congratulations.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Yeah. So what made you want to go ahead and write this book? And I'm sure, you know, I've heard a couple of interviews where you said you had a lot of stops and starts. What made you finally get into it and do it?
I think the first of all, the opportunity from the circumstance of the quarantine, of course, probably the biggest factor. Without the quarantine, I don't think it ever would have happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that the previous 3 years was a really big factor. 2017, 18, 19 were the three most productive years of my entire life, and reconnected me to my life's work in music. I hadn't planned on coming back into the music business at all, and it just happened by crazy circumstance, like most of my life.
Right.
And you know, and we ended up doing two new albums, Soulfire and Summer of Sorcery, and released six album packages in 3 years, which is about as productive as you can be. So
yeah, and they're beautiful, by the way, especially those box sets. Is just, I just love the colors and the psychedelic look to it, and even the albums themselves. Like, it's, and we're going to get into this because the book to me is such a love letter to music, just in general, and rock and roll. But those albums are just all different types. 1 minute you're getting, especially for Summer of Sorcery, you've got 1 minute there's like blaxploitation theme song music, then the next minute there's Mama. It's all over the place, but it somehow works so very well. So, you know, you should be proud that you got back in. I'm glad you did.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it was very a nice surprise, and that came from that band which I assembled, you know, and Mark Ribler helped me assemble as my MD, as my music director. You know, they stayed with me the entire 3 years, and that really was a big factor, because it was the first time in my life I ever did two albums in a row with the same band. Mm-hmm. So it was really, really helpful. But anyway, ended up reconnecting with my own music, which I kind of abandoned, you know, for a mere 30 years or so.
Got a bit sidetracked.
You know, I got a little busy.
Yeah, you had a little gig, yeah.
And that really kind of provided a kind of closure, you know, for that part of my life. You know, not that it's completely over yet. You know, I'm still hoping for a big fourth quarter, but right. You know, it kind of provided a little bit of a beginning, middle, and end, you know, musically, and so it, you know, I think it was just the right time to do it. My new managers encouraged me to do it, and I got a great editor, a guy named Ben Greenman, very big help. I told him I don't want it to be a typical biography. You know, I don't want to do just a music book for music people.
Right.
You know, I wanted it to be some bigger themes than that. And I wanted it to be kind of balanced between three different tracks. You know, yes, we have the narrative, of course, but I also wanted to have history, because I witnessed almost the entire, history of rock and roll, except for the first decade.
Yeah.
And then I wanted the third track would be the crafts that I've been involved with, because I've been involved with a dozen different crafts through the years. So, you know, that balance between the narrative, the history, and the craft, I was hoping would help make the book basically useful in the end. You know?
Yeah, and it's, you know, you can definitely tell it's in your own voice right away, and not just because I'm listening to you read it, but you can you can absolutely tell, you know, as an Italian, we know when other Italians are talking. So,
but that's how I wrote it. You know, I said, you know, because that was a big question of, you know, how am I going to do it? How am I going to make it in my own voice? Because I'd read a lot of biographies, and you know, they all have co-writers, which immediately homogenizes it, I think.
Yep.
You know, but I wrote every word of this, obviously, and I said to myself, I'm going to try and write it the way I would speak it, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
And I told the editor and I told the publisher, I said, this is not going to look right. It's not going to be grammatically correct. There's going to be fragments all over the place. I said, but if you read it the way I'm writing it, you're going to hear my voice. And I got lucky with that.
Yeah, you do. And let's talk about some of these tracks that you mentioned, like these different paths, because, you know, it, as much as I'm a fan of, you know, Bruce and the E Street Band and the other things that you've done, Underground Garage, all of those things, I don't know the little nuances to the point where, especially that you played a lot of parts in encouraging Bruce to do things that almost left you out in the beginning. Like you were almost kind of managing it with him and gave him suggestions that ultimately led to you not being part of it in the beginning when he got signed.
Yeah, this book will only be used in Harvard Business School as a bad example. you know, here's what you don't do, kids. Okay. The whole list of my brilliant business acumen throughout. I don't know, for some reason, and I've tried to analyze this. I've always been kind of secure in who I am, and I'm not particularly needy in terms of either the spotlight or anything. You know, I've always felt like I could make a living somehow. I don't know where that comes from. I guess the early years, you know, even though my mother divorced my father when I was very young, like 2 or 3 years old, which is supposed to be traumatic and kind of make you insecure. Yeah. We moved in with my Italian grandparents, and I was the first grandchild. So, you know,
so you were swarmed.
I got way too much love. So I think your security maybe, you know, starts that young, you know, where you have that much love from aunts and uncles and grandparents and, you know, that Italian thing, you know, I think just made me secure, I think, my whole life.
Yeah, but I don't see, like, I know you joke about it, but I don't see that as you making bad decisions. I see that as you making decisions that you know are right, no matter the consequences. And, yeah. You know, and you know, just for, you know, the suggestion to Bruce that he uses his name and things like that, that, you know, are selfless, but ultimately turned out to be right. And
that's the thing. Yeah, I don't make business the priority. I've never made money the priority. I just don't. Yeah. I don't really, you know, I don't waste it, but I don't respect it either. You know, when it comes to money, I just have never respected it. You know, and that doesn't mean I throw it away or I waste it. You know, people are always saying I spend too much on my projects. Well, but that is in pursuit of greatness. You know. It's not in pursuit of wasting money for the hell of it. You know, when I spend money on something, it's because I have to in order to reach a certain level of greatness and you know, raise it up to my standards. And that's just how I am. I just decided early on I'm going to be more about quality than quantity. That's just how I am.
Yeah. And that business of music is a common theme too, of how it almost interferes with the creativity and your ability to do what you want more than anything else. As a matter of fact, that's kind of one of the reasons why you left the E Street Band to begin with, is just because the decisions were, as it was becoming a bigger, I guess, machine is the word I would use at the time, your input wasn't as valid. And considering that you were right a lot, I could see how that would bother you.
It's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically, It was a perfect storm of a number of things all at once. You know, my obsession with politics at that point, my feeling of obligation to do something about the injustices that I was seeing being done with our tax dollars. I was offered a solo deal at the same time. And then, you know, I wanted to institutionalize my advice at that point to Bruce rather than it just being friendly advice from a friend. You know, I felt like, you know, I should be part of the official decision-making machinery, as you put it. And, you know, so it was a number of things all at once that led to me leaving, and it got very, very emotional. And I ended up leaving. You know, luckily, you know, the three times in our lives we've had those kind of fights, you know, we reconcile pretty quickly. So
that's good.
Doesn't last very long, yeah.
For sure. But, you know, you do mention the politics part, and this is something to me that is a very important topic because, you know, it takes a lot of guts to put your name on the line for something you believe in. And I remember at the time that you did that, people were saying things like, you know, keep your and they do. Bono gets this all the time too. Keep your politics out of it and just do the music. When really, I mean, the era of rock and roll that birthed most music was more political than ever in the 60s. Like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and all of these groups that, like, their whole purpose was politics. You know, the whole purpose was to speak out about the unjust, and now all of a sudden it's flipping and it's now, oh, leave, if they don't agree with you, it's leave the politics out of it, you know? So did you get a lot of backlash from that? Or, I mean, cause it's such a cause that I can't see anyone on earth saying, yeah, I'm for apartheid. I mean, I just don't understand like why would we have backlash for that?
But, and at the time Reagan supported apartheid.
Yeah.
That's right. And that was the thing. You know, by the 80s, I think the audience was expanding to the point where the entire rock thing was becoming more mainstream, more and more, you know, bigger and bigger. And so, you know, in the 80s were there's a lot of escapism going on. There was a lot of you know, mourning in America from the grandfatherly cowboy president, you know, so, and meanwhile, there's an entire, you know, crime empire going on behind him, you know, criminal empire. In the end, I didn't get a whole lot. I got the backlash, but by then I was already gone. You know, once I left the E Street Band, I disappeared completely. So, I mean, years later, when Bono picked up the flag, he got hit a little bit harder because he was already successful. You know, he was having a successful career with U2, and so people, you know, he was famous enough to be disappointing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, right.
I was not, and so I wasn't disappointing anybody. It's like my live shows. You know, there's one positive thing about never having a hit. You know, I never disappoint. I never disappoint anybody by not playing their favorite song. You know, so it gives you a lot of freedom. Right. So I think, you know, for me, I got death threats and the basics, you know, that come with anything having to do with racism.
Right.
You know, which now, of course, we're, you know, just drowning in it. You know, it's hard to believe that how backwards we're going right now. But at that time, I wasn't really disappointing my fans. I didn't have any. You know, the E Street Nation had moved on, and they never really accepted my solo career. You know, so you know, it wasn't a whole lot of business problems as much as you know, just you know, it brought the white supremacists out of the woodwork, and they were still in the woodwork back then. You know, they weren't being elected president of the United States yet.
I couldn't agree with you more. So now and then on top, I will say this, though. I've seen you two many times, and Bono did mention you once when he was talking about it. He mentioned you. He mentioned just that you played such a big part of this. So he did give you credit on stage at the show. This I definitely remember that.
Oh yeah, you know, he got so into the Sun City project, he wrote a whole song for it. You know,
yeah.
It just organically turned into an album, and I mean really organically. It was an amazing, amazing artistic accomplishment, really, when you look back on it now. The four of us, you know, we started off just doing a single, me, Danny Schechter, Arthur Baker, and Hart Perry. It just started off as a single and turned into an album, and Bono actually contributed an entire song to it. So he was into it, and he's done a great job picking up the political flag. He's accomplished a lot.
Yeah. So look, what you did was very brave, and it should be noted for sure. And you know, it's not easy for someone to put themselves out there and let their views be known, because most of the time you're telling, unfortunately these days, half the country, I don't agree with you. And that's never a bold move, but never a safe move, I should say.
I think one more thing, before we start looking at me like some kind of hero here, believe me, it was really helpful that I had nothing to lose at that point. You know what I mean? Yeah. I didn't just change jobs when I left the E Street Band. I ended my life. I mean, it was over and nothing in front of me, you know, staring into the abyss, you know. So having nothing to lose, I think, helped me focus on that particular subject, because that was it. That was all I had.
Did you ever get to meet Mandela?
Yeah, twice. Once we did two Wembley shows, one to get him out of jail, and then one to celebrate that he got out. Mm-hmm. Met him there in London, and then he did a fundraising tour for the ANC, his political party, when they decided to have the first election in South Africa, which of course he would be elected president. And he came to, I think, 10 cities or so in the United States to each city guaranteed them $500,000 each. And they came to me to help out with that. Mm-hmm.
So what, how does then, you know, you mentioned this abyss and not having anything to lose. And is that also part of the reason why you wind up involved with the Sopranos? Because it's just become something completely different than what you've done. And did you always want to do acting, or was it how does that come to you? I do know that you were supposed to play Tony at first.
The entire thing was just one big gift from David Chase. I had never intended to be an actor. I never thought about it. I thought about maybe writing. You know, I had some treatments that I'd written. A couple of screenplays, thought maybe I would direct something if I got something sold as a screenplay, but I never thought about acting. And so it was just a gift from David Chase saying, you know, come be in my TV show. Mm-hmm. And he was just into breaking all the rules at that point. He had been in TV his whole life, you know, since, I don't know, Rockford Files or even earlier. And, you know, it was going to be his last TV show. He wanted to get into the movies and start making movies, which, you know, his second movie just came out, you know, the Saints of Newark.
Of course,
Not Fade Away before that, which was great. But he was like into, you know, he wanted new faces. He wanted just to break every possible rule. Yeah. So he came to me to play Tony. HBO said, are you out of your mind?
Did they see any tests? Did you do any tests for them to say that?
But people forget HBO wasn't anything back then. It was just a little network with a football show and a couple of semi-porno movies, you know. I mean, it was nothing special. You know, it didn't become this amazing, you know, juggernaut that it is now. So they were like, you know, it's the biggest investment we're ever going to make. You know, you can't cast him. And they saw the test. I read for them, and they were like, yo, he's great. He can be in it, but not the lead. You know, so at that point, David asked me, you know, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, now that I think about it, because it had been such a hurricane, I said, you know, I'm starting to feel guilty about taking an actor's job. You know, my wife's an actor. I see what she goes through. It goes to classes for years and off Broadway. And I'm like, I don't feel that good about taking an actor's job. So he says, all right, you're not going to take an actor's job. I'll write you in a part that doesn't exist. So I was like, wow, he really must want me in a show, you know. And he says, what do you want to do? I said, well, I got, you know, a couple of treatments I'd written, one of which was about a hitman named Silvio Dante that had a Copacabana type of club. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of lived in the past. You know, it was set in present day, but he kind of romanticized the good old days of the mob and had a Copacabana type of club with big bands and dancing girls and Jewish Catskills comics and the whole schmear. And the five families had tables in the club and the police commissioner and the mayor. And, you know, it was kind of a mob Casablanca kind of a thing.
Very cool concept.
Yeah. And he says, well, that's cool. And he takes it to HBO and he comes back and says, we can't afford it, so we'll make it a strip club.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. The way it winds up is very, I wouldn't say ironic, but, you know, you mention a few times in the book that you don't mind being the guy behind the guy. You never, even when you were young, you know, when you fantasize about being, you know, on stage or whatever it was never as the main guy, which I found really interesting because, like, who doesn't do that? You know, it was a very unique perspective. And then the role that you wind up playing phenomenally on top of that is the guy behind the guy yet again. You know, it's but it is, you know, it's so weird to have a character like Silvio, the way you play it. He's so likable and so funny, but yet they're not good people. But yet at the same time, like, it's you play it as a guy, like, I just loved the character. You've made me laugh, not only in this book, but like in that Soprano so many times. You know, it's just very funny.
Well, that's the paradox. You know, that's the complicated contradiction of the show. I mean, you know, the genius, I think, of David Chase and the other writers was making what has become, you know, quite a boring profession these days. I mean, it's not the roaring 20s anymore, you know.
Right, yeah.
You know, so how do you, you know, how do you make a profession like that compelling, you know? And that was the brilliant balance between one's work and one's family. You know, that's a common, you know, very universal kind of theme. And in that setting, it was just unique and just brilliant writing, which made a really a boring sort of profession into something that was, you know, entertaining.
Yeah, and everybody has fascination with the mob and mob stories and things like that. For anyone, I mean, if you haven't watched all the Sopranos, I don't know what rock you're under, but there's a spoiler coming. So when the time comes that, you know, Silvio dies, how far ahead do you know?
Whoa.
Where?
He didn't die.
For the shot?
No, he's in a coma.
Oh, well, I mean, okay.
just waiting for that sequel.
Okay. My apologies. Well, when Silvio goes into the coma.
He's on life support.
And he's shot up, yes. How are you told that's the end? Like, are you, do you know a very early on that's the end of him? Or for now?
If you're going to die, yeah, then David, you know, you get the phone call. Which is, you know, can you come to lunch tomorrow? and that's the phone call everybody dreaded, you know.
Yeah.
We kind of stayed friendly throughout, you know, and have remained good friends. So I don't think I got that phone call because I wasn't going to die. So you know, I was going to get shot up in that last or next to last episode, but you know, it wasn't going to be an absolute death. So I didn't have to, I didn't worry about it.
Yeah, it's and it, to go out in a gunfight's a good way to go too. At least it's definitely a more mob like way to go out for sure. Into the coma for the sequel. So you know, you also mentioned how HBO at the time didn't have a lot of shows, a lot of big shows. You also are a pioneer in that way with Lilyhammer, because Netflix was one of the very first original shows.
The first.
So it was their first original show, and they were a DVD company at the time. Mm. And you know, this one's it still has funny. It's maybe a little more lighthearted, maybe a lot more lighthearted. But you know, at the core, there are some similarities to the characters. How'd you wind up getting that done and getting that made?
It's one of those weird things, you know. I'm producing a record in Norway for my record company, and guy says there's a couple here to say hello, husband and wife. And they say hello. We're basically comedy. You know, we're successful comedy writers, and we've written a TV show for you.
Wow, that's right.
You know, something you don't hear every day.
Yeah.
You know? So I was like, what? What is it? He said, well, gangster goes in witness protection program and chooses Lilyhammer, Norway. You know, and I said, oh, man, you know, I just played a gangster for 10 years. You know, I really shouldn't do that. You know, you're not supposed to do that as an actor. I'm just starting this whole new profession here. And, you know, you're supposed to show how versatile you are, you know. And I just couldn't resist, because I knew, even though the character was going to look similar and sound similar, it was quite a different character, actually. Much more outgoing, much more of a boss, you know, much more Tony Soprano type.
Okay, yeah.
Than a Silvio type. Mm-hmm. And I never heard of anybody starring in a foreign country's local show before.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it was just so weird. I said, I got to do this, you know?
Yeah.
And they made me one of the producers and one of the writers. And I figured, if I'm one of the producers and one of the writers, I can protect myself, yeah. You know, enough. But we got over there, and 6 weeks in, I realized we could not afford to shoot the show that we wrote. And we spent a long time writing it, figuring it out, because it was a very tricky premise. I didn't want it to be a straight-ahead comedy. You know, it had to be a dramedy as far as I was concerned. I didn't want anybody trying to be funny. Mm-hmm. The humor had to come from circumstance or from character. How much English should there be, you know? And you know, the premise was my guy understood Norwegian but didn't speak it. So we'd have some English in the show. Mm-hmm. You know, and there we were. And I realized we can't afford to do this. So I called the agent in L.A. I said, you know, book a couple of meetings. I'm coming in. We got to try and sell this thing to America. And Stars was the first meeting. You know, a friend of mine, Chris Albrecht, who had come from HBO, and he wanted the show. But I said, you know, I needed $1 million a show, which was still low compared to a typical hour-long, you know, drama series. You know, the average was probably around $3 million. And, you know, an extra million basically got me not even two-thirds of the way there. But I needed at least that. And Chris didn't have the money. He says, you know, my budget's gone for this year. He says, I'll give you $2 million next year. But I said, Chris, this is not going in my pocket. I need this for the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, so across the street was this new place that just opened, happened to be across the street, called Netflix. Call up, you know, Ted got on the phone and he says, come on over. And that was it.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
We made a deal in an hour. And it's the greatest business deal of my life.
Yep.
You know, a two-year deal, which I think that might have been the first 2-year deal in TV history.
Yeah, probably.
You know, even successful shows, they only do 1 year at a time. Yeah. You know, so it was, you know, it's one of those great, great stories that if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, you know, I'd find hard to believe. But
see, that's the part that Harvard Business School would study.
Right, yeah, there you go.
It's very valuable.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe.
Now, but, so you,
but, you know, but you know, you're not going to see too many guys with the courage of a Ted Sarandos. I tell you the truth.
Yep.
You know that's old school. The guy running the content, making the decision.
Yep.
He didn't call up the CFO or the accountant or, you know, the bean counter and say, you know, can we do this? You know, yeah. like most people do. He was like, I'll make this deal right now.
That's awesome.
And he just deserves all the success that he's had. I mean, he's one of the great visionaries, I think, in the history of the business.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more. Now, we don't have too much time left, but you mentioned one of the great stories. There's one in the book. It's only a sentence or two, but I need elaboration because as soon as you said it, I was like, I need to know more about that. And this goes back to the music part. You got to go to Abbey Road and listen to the original four-track of Sgt. Pepper. That to me was like, wow, that's the book's done now. That's the greatest thing ever. Like, yeah.
I mean, I'm telling you right now, I know this is hard to believe, but there's something different about the old analog system, you know, as opposed to the digital world, which now we live in. And there's no going back. You know, we're going to be in the digital world forever more.
Yeah.
But there was something different about the analog communication that I think affected you physically. You know, I can't prove it. You know, I don't know what the science is, but I swear to you, you know, I mean, they were making great, you know, they were making great progress with autistic children, you know, in the old days with analog music. Mm-hmm. And I haven't heard anything about that lately, you know, so I bet you the digital domain has probably affected that also. But anyway, I listened to this album, and I'm telling you, I was physically high, like you got high for a couple of days afterwards.
That's,
you know,
amazing.
It was just the most amazing sound. And it just went into you physically, just the way those old vinyl singles used to go into you physically. You know, I described that in the book in great detail because it affected me literally, physically, and I think everybody. You know, you would listen to a song hundreds of times.
Yep.
Hundreds of times. Nobody does that anymore.
No, nope. You know, they don't even listen to albums anymore.
No, no. You know? But I mean, nobody listens to a digital anything hundreds of times. No. They just don't. You know, because there's something superficial about it in some physical way that doesn't quite connect the way the old analog did. And I don't know, like I say, I don't know the science, you know, scientists might tell me I'm crazy, but I have no doubt in my mind. I wore out singles. And that means, you know, like 700-800 times you had to play it to wear it out.
Yeah.
It means something ridiculous. And this experience with Sgt. Pepper, I'm telling you, I was just floating 6 inches off the ground for a couple of days.
So was it the original four-track machine too that they did it on?
It would have had to be. I mean, I don't know what they mixed down to. They might have mixed it down to a two-track half inch or one inch even. I don't remember now what the actual technology was, but it was the original, as original in the analog state as could be. Yeah.
And so you walked in there and it's the same studio. Was that your first time in Abbey Road or have you been there before?
That was my first time there, actually. Yeah. I've been there several times since. But just seeing, you know, that room that's in, you know, Help, you know, the movie Help, where they're recording You're Gonna Lose That Girl.
Yep.
The first time I think we ever saw the inside of Abbey Road. And it looks just like that. You know, it's there it is. Yeah. Where the Beatles actually recorded, and it blows your mind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something. When I heard that, I was like, I gotta know more about that because it's my favorite group ever. You know, like who isn't? But you know, all of these for those of you watching and listening, like all of these stories are there. But you know, in addition to if you don't listen to Underground Garage, And there's just so much great music that people haven't heard or just doesn't get played on other stations and things. And Stevie keeps that alive, both with Underground Garage, but just listening to you just tell all of these stories about everything from, you know, the Stone Pony and all of these origins. I can't stress enough to check out this book. If you can get the audio version, you know what? Buy both. Support the guy. It's a wonderful book. But once again, he also has a apothecary that he started, a cannabis product, which is CBD, THC, a little more balanced, so you don't get totally whacked. You just feel good. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, well, it's part of our... I think the quarantine and the virus, you know, kind of inspired us to do something for the immune system. So we started making these teas and coffee is on its way, and lollipops with, you know, just good herbs and healthy, you know, a little bit of wellness, with various ginger and turmeric and various, you know, good spices. And then, so we continue the thing with the cannabis product that was a little bit more balanced toward the CBD than the THC, which means, you're going to get a mild, mellow high, but it's more for the body and for those people who really need it for medicinal purposes and to relax, or first time smokers, or, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a little bit more on the health side than the high, get high side for this first product. Anyway, you know, we may get into the higher stuff later. We'll see. But, you know, but mostly, to tell you the truth, I just wanted to make a statement that it should be legal. I mean, it's ridiculous that it's not legal everywhere.
It's crazy.
Fentanyl is legal. You know, I mean, I lost half my friends in the business from fentanyl, booze. I mean, you know, compare it to alcohol. There's no comparison. You know, there's no reason at all why ganja, you know, by when marijuana should be illegal. It's ridiculous. Yeah. So we're giving a percentage of it to normal, you know, the organization that, you know, trying to legalize it and working on legalizing it. And it's right now, it's just in Massachusetts. That's it. And we're doing an event. I want to say the 18th, I think it is. November 18th.
Okay. This will be out by then. Yeah. So the best thing, I know we've talked about a lot of stuff, but if you go to littlesteven.com, yeah, everything is there. It's a beautiful site too, but everything is there. So if you want to know everything from Little Underground Garage to the shows we talked about, to the music, to just go there. You can get information on everything and check out the book. You know, you often refer and quote things from the unwritten book in your book. It's not unwritten anymore. You've done it. Stevie, thank you so very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And best of luck with everything.
You really deserve all this success. It's great that it's happening. It's happened.
Thank you both. Good talking to you.
Thank you for watching The Hole. I am Rob Sprantz.
And I'm Lori Levine.
Later, motherfuckers.